the tools of ecology, the numerical methods that ecologists have developed to study shifts in biodiversity and composition in ecosystems, could fill in that gap where, while we wait for more insights about the cellular and molecular processes that really allows us to, with a lot of precision, modulate the behavior and function of the microbiome, while we still don't have that level of insight, precision, and control, tools from managing ecosystems that have been developed by ecologists, the theory and the principles could be potentially applied for managing the microbiome in the context of patients receiving cancer therapy.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This episode is part of our podcast series on leveraging microbial ecology for health. In this series, we speak with experts about shaping microbial ecosystems using various tools, including biotics, to create positive effects on health.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And on today's podcast, we're delighted to have Xavier from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, which is a bit of a mouthful, where you work in the Program for Computational and Systems Biology. And your main interest, I guess, or at least what we want to discuss with you here today, is the link between the human microbiome, or microbiota, I don't know which term you prefer, and cancer. Now, that's quite a leap, I think, the human microbiome and cancer. How did you get into this field? And can you give us, or at least our listeners, an overview of what you think the links are between bacteria and cancer?
Yeah, so my background has always been in microbial ecology, studying how different species of bacteria interact with each other in the environment, in wastewater treatment, and in nature in general. And I joined Memorial Sloan Kettering 15 years ago as a junior faculty to continue my research program on microbial interactions in basic science, microbial interactions, but also to expand my work into cancer biology. I was really interested in studying how different cancer cells interact with each other in tumors and how they interact with cells of the immune system. But I joined at that time where colleagues of mine already at Sloan Kettering were getting very interested in how the composition of the gut microbiota might shift while patients receive cancer therapy, specifically bone marrow transplantations, which is cancer therapy for hematological malignancies. It's a very well-defined type of treatment. And they got really interested in this, and they started collecting fecal samples from patients receiving these bone marrow transplantations and trying to analyze their microbiota compositions. And opportunistically, that this was a great match for my skill set. So it's something that I didn't envision immediately before. But once I joined Sloan Kettering, I saw that opportunity where my skill set could be really valuable to collaborate with physician scientists at Sloan Kettering. And we started on that project, and it just turned out to expand into a whole research program that's been very insightful. It has produced many interesting findings.
Yeah, that's really fascinating that you kind of fell into this area, which is now so important. But do you find yourself, and please, you know, excuse this question, do you find yourself at oncology conferences being the kind of strange guy in the corner talking about bacteria, or is this becoming somewhat central to oncology conferences and the way people regard cancer?
Yeah, so I see more and more in oncology settings, in conferences, institutes, and so on, that people are interested in the gut microbiome as an aspect of human health that's worth exploring. You know, in the context of the bone marrow transplantation, these are patients who become immune compromised. So they're, you know, the therapy is very intense, and they have usually a period that's called neutropenia, where they don't have white blood cells practically. And that can last weeks or sometimes months. And so during that time, the patient is immune compromised. And they're susceptible to all sorts of opportunistic infections that can happen during that time. And like the bone marrow transplantation, which is maybe a very, very intense example of a cancer therapy, there's other types of cancer therapies, there is chemotherapy, that's cytotoxic, that have impacts on the immune system. And that can leave patients susceptible to opportunistic infections. And many times these infections start from bacteria that we already have ourselves living with us in our microbiome. They would not cause any problem if we were otherwise healthy. But if we're going through cancer therapy that compromises our immunity, they can become an issue. So that's kind of a first line of problems that might come from the microbiome that people get interested in, you know, how the microbiome would naturally prevent bad bacteria from causing problems, and how during cancer therapy, there could be shifts in the microbiome that could predispose patients for these problems. And so those aspects, I think more and more people interested in, and also in the way that the microbiome might interact with the normal immune system function as well, and how that could be potentially leveraged to make more effective cancer therapies. So in cancer immunotherapies, for example, is there ways to modulate the microbiome to try to optimize those therapies? That's another aspect that it's been very, very important and I see more and more people get interested in.
And you've taken a very principle-based approach. You've taken what you know about ecosystem management to translate that into the oncology setting, because these oncology settings really are shocks to the system. So can you talk to us about how you view like ways we can use the knowledge we have from ecosystem management to improve outcomes for patients being treated for cancer?
Right, right. So, you know, ecology and molecular and cell biology, they're, you know, considered different branches of biology, and they have different schools of thoughts, different principles that are usually applied. And in many universities, they're actually separate departments where there's crosstalk, obviously, but they're considered to be almost different disciplines. And what I've been also trying to do is to ask in a situation like the gut microbiome, where we're talking about an ecosystem with multiple, you know, hundreds, thousands of different microbial species interacting with each other, where we don't necessarily know all the molecular processes by which the bacteria interact with each other and how they impact the host, the health of host, our health, right? What are the molecules involved and how at the cellular level this changes? We might not know that. And so this is, I think, where ecology could be helpful, but the tools of ecology, the numerical methods that ecologists have developed to study shifts in biodiversity and composition in ecosystems could fill in that gap where, while we wait for more insights about the cellular and molecular processes that really allows us to, with a lot of precision, modulate the behavior and function of the microbiome, while we still don't have that level of insight, precision, and control, tools from managing ecosystems that have been developed by ecologists, the theory and the principles could be potentially applied for managing the microbiome in the context of patients receiving cancer therapy. I think it might be more broad than that, but might be even outside of cancer therapy, that principles from ecology could be potentially used to maintain the necessary functions that our microbiome provides to us, the host. And so I think that's where ecology can fill in the gap.
So, Shah, I can pretty easily accept that somebody with cancer, particularly any kind of advanced cancer, will, their diet will change, they're on medication, they're going in and out of hospitals, they're, you know, their entire lifestyle and their environment changes, and therefore you would expect the microbiome to change mm-hmm. as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And that is, in a sense, a change as a result of cancer, but it's not a direct link. Do you mm-hmm. think, well, maybe it is a direct link, do you think it works? Is there any evidence that it works the other way as well, that change in the microbiome can precede cancer or can exacerbate cancer? You've talked about it affecting treatment, and I'd like to come back to that as well. But mm-hmm. what about that question of is it causal or consequential, which, of course, is one of the big questions facing microbiome science?
Exactly. So whether shifts in the microbiome might be linked to the development of cancer, I myself have not worked in this area yet. I believe it's an area where there's a lot of interest. Perhaps where it will be more important is in the development of colorectal cancer, because colorectal cancer develops in the intestine, and it's, you know, the cells are in direct contact with the intestinal microbiota. And so I can definitely imagine that the link there will be very proximate. But of course, people keep thinking about whether, you know, the many impacts that the microbiota, the gut microbiota, but also skin, lung, oral, because of its many ways that it can influence a host's health, both locally and systemically, could be linked to risks of cancers. Okay, so those are emerging areas, and they're areas of very interesting research that we still don't know that much. In the context of the research that I've done, I believe that the cause and consequence are a bit clearer. And this is because we focused primarily on patients receiving bone marrow transplantation. They walk in with gut microbiota that have high level of biodiversity, not exactly the same one as a healthy, random healthy person on the street, but they have a high level of biodiversity. But as they prepare for the bone marrow transplantation, they start getting prophylactic antibiotics. At Sloan Kettering, it's a combination of vancomycin and ciprofloxacin, but other treatment centers will have other prophylaxis. And that antibiotic prophylaxis starts causing drastic shifts. You know, there's massive losses of the biodiversity of the intestinal microbiota. We see expansions of facultative anaerobes that they can take up practically 100% of the bacteria in the intestine. And once they dominate the intestine, they predispose the patient to bloodstream infections. So during the bone marrow transplantation, if your gut microbiota is dominated by a vancomycin-resistant enterococcus or a multi-drug-resistant Klebsiella pneumoniae, the risk that you'll develop a bloodstream infection during that period of immune compromise increases a lot. And those are drastic shifts where we see massive losses of diversity, expansions of bacteria that are potentially opportunistic pathogens. And that, I think, is quite unique to the bone marrow transplantation patients, and where we have a window into population dynamics of the gut microbiome that really allows us to understand what's going on. In this patient population, the main factor causing the shifts is the antibiotics. You know, there's the antibiotic prophylaxis, and then if there's a symptom like a neutropenic fever, a fever that occurs when the patient is immunocompromised, so potentially very, very serious, immediately the clinicians change the antibiotics to try to respond to that fever. We see then changes in the microbiota in response to those changes in antibiotic. And so it's a very, very clear window when we start collecting samples practically every day, fecal samples from patients hospitalized for bone marrow transplantation. And we look at the charts, at the timelines where we see the populations of the different bacteria in the gut microbiome. It's very, very clear, even by eye, you can see, you know, as the antibiotics start being administered and changed in response to symptoms, you see changes co-occurring in the microbiota composition. That's very, very, you know, clear. We can have very strong signal to noise and extract, even quantify the impacts of these antibiotics on specific gut bacteria. And then we start analyzing other more nuanced effects. So once the gut microbiota starts changing, we also have from these patients all the complete blood counts measured as a patient receives therapy, so we can know what's their population in different white blood cells, neutrophils, lymphocytes, monocytes, and we can start studying how the shifts of the gut microbiota might cause delays in the immune reconstitution, you know, in the patient regaining immunity. So that's kind of a second level of causality that we can also extract from observing these patients. But, you know, the causality, I believe, in our system, in the system that we study most, the bone marrow transplantation patients, is very, very strong and clear. When we're trying to generalize that beyond bone marrow transplantation into other cancer populations, and even more general than that into the broader population, it's a bit harder, right? Because the bone marrow transplantation is such an example of very, very strong perturbations on the ecosystem, on the bacterial ecosystem that we have inside our guts. If we're trying to compare that with what's going on in the average healthy person going around, what happens when they change their diet, or even when they take mild antibiotics, you know, in response to some ear infection, for example, we don't see those strong shifts as clearly as they happen in bone marrow transplantation. I think that's both an advantage and a disadvantage, right? So it's an advantage because it enables us to establish cause and effect. It has a clear significance for this particular patient population. The disadvantage is that it's harder to ask exactly how general what we're finding in this patient is that we could apply it potentially to other cancers, other diseases, or even just to understand the microbiome even in healthy settings.
Can you help us understand, for the setting of stem cell transplantation, are we using the monitoring of the microbiome right now to inform treatment?
Yeah, so we're not. And this is, you know, I published very recently this year a review article in the journal Nature Reviews in Clinical Oncology. And my goal with that review is really to get clinicians, clinical oncologists, more aware about what we're doing. And in that article, I not only make the case that ecological principles could be applied, but I also try to ask, why aren't we doing this right now? Right? Or why aren't we just regularly monitoring the microbiome of patients receiving cancer right now? At Sloan Kettering, we monitored patients and we had a prospective study that lasted more than 15 years and is still acquiring new data, where we were monitoring practically everyone, a sample practically every day. So for Sloan Kettering has more than 200 bone marrow transplants per year. So that over 15 years, we really acquired data on thousands of patients. And we couldn't apply those data back to the clinic because it takes a long time. It's for research purposes. So we get a fecal sample. Before we get the data back to the clinic, we would gather several samples so that we could process them all at once and lower the cost. So, you know, in practice, it would take several weeks until we get the data back to the clinic. So I think that's one of the bottlenecks and probably one of the reasons why it's not applied in the clinic, is that in order to get it fast enough back to clinicians so they can be, you know, can assist their decisions, can be clinically actionable, we would need to try to get that down to one day would be the best, and, you know, next day or 2 days. And I'm sure that if there's the motivation to do it, we can do it. So the how do we get that motivation? I think the problem there is we really need to provide the evidence that this could be, you know, a benefit for the patients. And that's what I want to work on for the next months, 2 years, is to really set up the evidence that this can bring this type of information, just knowing what the microbiota composition is over time, how that can bring clinical value, clinical benefit for the patients. And the second aspect is, I think the data alone can only get you so far, but the data with the proper computer models to analyze those data and calculate, you know, potential outcomes, risk scores, is this patient at a high risk or blood infection? You know, it's not going to be beneficial for the recovery of the patient, right? How can we steer that back? I think the computer models are also going to be really critical. But I think we're really at that stage where both the technology for computer models and the technology to sequence the data fast enough is getting into place. So I would be very, very surprised if within 5 years we wouldn't have a platform like that.
And I can see how we're mapping, you know, the microbiome during treatment of infection. That's, you know, that'd be incredible to do that. What would it lead to? I mean, would it lead to stratification of patients towards different treatments? Or do you think the treatments will also have to be, you know, in the area of microbial ecology? Can you, for example, imagine people getting FMT, fecal microbiota transplants, along with their bone marrow transplants?
Yeah.
Or is there a role for probiotics, you know, in infusion of large numbers of very safe microbes, or prebiotics for that matter, to promote the growth of these beneficial microbes? Do you see roles for that?
Yeah, definitely. So I think in terms of managing infections in patients like immunocompromised, like cancer patients, monitoring the microbiome could really allow the clinicians to foresee that an infection is at high risk of happening several days before the infection happens. And the current way that an infection is treated is reactive, right? So there's a fever, and so then the doctors change the antibiotics. It's called empiric antibiotic treatment, and order a bloodstream analysis to find out what the bacteria is. And so monitoring the microbiome could change this presently reactive approach to a more proactive approach. So, you know, try to anticipate infection before it happens. And in the context of bone marrow transplantation, that could be the difference between life or death, if you could, you know, see an infection a few days before it's happening. But that's, you know, kind of risk assessment. Then I think there's two other areas where both the monitoring and computer models could help a lot. One of them is if we can predict how the microbiome composition is going over time with predictive computer models, That could allow the clinician to simulate forward in time, potential scenarios and assist them in the choice of antibiotic therapies. For example, if they have choice between two antibiotics, they could just simulate, if I give antibiotic A, the microbiome is going to go in one direction. And if I give them antibiotic B, then it's going to go in another direction that's more beneficial. And the computer model could help you map out those future trajectories. The other area that touches more upon probiotics is if the patient has a microbiome at a certain state that's undesirable, that microbiome is not what we want for that patient because it has too high levels of an opportunistic pathogen like a Klebsiella pneumonia, or the diversity is just too low, doesn't have the necessary microbial functions. So what would be the right mixture of microbes to give to that patient to try to steer it into the direction that we have, that we want for the patient? And I think that's where computer models could also help in this kind of rational design of mixtures of microbes to give to the patient in a personalized way to really fill in the ecological niches and provide the functions that we want to benefit that patient.
I think the approach too, because you've taken a very principled approach to laying out how ecosystem management should be used in cancer settings, is also going to be relevant for guiding the selection of immunocheckpoint inhibitor, like immunotherapy strategies, which have been revolutionary, because there has been some evidence that the presence or absence of certain microbes may explain heterogeneity and those effects.
So. Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that's the most obvious kind of offshoot of what we learn from bone marrow transplantations would be in assisting in immunotherapies, where hopefully, you know, links that we learn between specific types of gut bacteria and immunodynamics in the patient, that knowledge could potentially benefit either in the stratification of patients or in pre-immunotherapy conditioning with probiotics to steer in a direction that is desirable, that would make it more likely for immunotherapy to work. So that's really where I think we would need the most immediate generalization of what we're doing beyond bone marrow transplantation.
I like the approach you take too, because you try to think about how do we want that microbiota to look. You don't think, let's just supplement with a specific microbe. You may be able to get the outcome you want by supplementing with prebiotics or other kind of things that could determine the ultimate composition.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in the end, if we develop a computer model that understands very well how the microbiota ecology will change over time and how it will be impacted by different perturbations or by inserting different incoming microbes, that would open up possibilities for all sorts of rational design of how to steer prebiotics and therapies to kind of guide the composition of the microbiota to desired states, or the design of intervention of new microbes to give to the patients. But what I do believe is that you know, because, you know, ecology tells us that these systems are complicated, that there's all sorts of feedbacks between the bacterial species, it makes it hard to anticipate exactly how a particular perturbation might impact a complex ecosystem like this, or how they trying to insert a specific microbe, how that microbe, whether that microbe will take, or whether it will interact with the remaining microbiota in a, you know, and turn it into a desired way. So I often like to say that from the ecology point of view, we don't understand the microbiome algebra that much yet, right? So if a patient walks in and the patient is at a certain state, let's call that state A, and we want the patient to end in a certain state X, because we believe that certain state X is where the patient should be, how do we design a cocktail of bacteria, for example, state B, so that A plus B equals X? We don't know. We don't know the shape of that function plus, and we need to understand that better, right? So we need to understand the microbiome ecology to understand how do we design a certain therapy that's going to drive the microbiome composition as fast as possible to a desired state so that it would be beneficial for a patient in a highly dynamic setting such a cancer therapy.
So which not about the microbiome, but which of the many microbiomes do you think is the most important here? Is it the oral, the urogenital, the gut? I mean, obviously these people would have indwelling devices. There'd be, you know, punctures of the skin and so on. Is the skin microbiome important? Is it the gut microbiome or fecal microbiome, I suppose we should be more accurate, that, that you're looking at right now, or are you looking at multiple biomes?
Yeah, so our study focuses primarily on the gut microbiome, which we, in patients, we monitor through fecal samples. And we know it's not exactly the same, but it's a, that I think that's part of what we try to do as a research, which is with the tools that we have, what kind of clinical benefit can we bring to the patient? So the fecal sample is non-invasive. It's very cheap to get and would otherwise be flushed down the toilet, literally. So we can use it. Now, if this is the most impactful microbiome for the cancer patient, I believe it is one that is very impactful, right? And it's one that's known to play a major role in modulating immunity, both locally and systemically. So it is a really important one. You know, as a microbial ecologist, I'm always fascinated by, you know, how we're populated by different microbiomes. Our different body sites have different microbial populations. And that, you know, if you take two people, their oral microbiomes will be more similar than in the same person, the oral and the gut microbiome. And that's because, as microbial ecologists like to say, everything is everywhere, but the environment selects. That's kind of a saying that microbial ecologists really like. And the suggestion is that, in principle, any bacteria could get from your mouth to your gut, but they usually don't populate there because the environment in the gut provides the selective pressure for certain types of bacteria that only will live well there, right? And that's the reason why my oral microbiome is more similar to your oral microbiome than my oral microbiome is to my gut microbiome. So even though these two microbiomes occupy spaces in the same human body, the environment in the mouth is very, very different from the environment in the gut, and the environment skin likewise. Now, one of the interesting things that we also found that relates more to basic biology when we were looking at our bone marrow transplantation patients is that we saw that some patients got, we detected very high percentages of oral bacteria in their feces. And that was puzzling at first, that we were detecting this high percentage of oral bacteria in their feces. And they were, you know, unlike, so we were seeing a lot of streptococci in their feces. But unlike when patients get dominated by Klebsiella pneumoniae or dominated by vancomycin-resistant enterococcus, the streptococcus in the feces was not correlated with a higher risk of bloodstream infection by streptococcus. And we were a bit puzzled what was the exception, you know, why was streptococcus this exception? And what we concluded in the end is that since we're swallowing saliva all the time, and streptococcus lives in our oral microbiome, we're swallowing saliva all the time, there's DNA of streptococci, another oral bacteria, that ends up in our feces. But when we're healthy, it's a very, very residual amount. So in terms of percentages, it's less than 1% of the bacterial DNA that we find in feces comes from oral bacteria. However, in patients whose gut microbiota got completely devastated by microbiomes, by antibiotics, excuse me, amount of gut bacteria decreased so substantially that the DNA from oral bacteria starts to look much bigger. It's the same amount, but in percentage, its amount goes up. And so then we say sometimes often 90% of the DNA from bacteria in the feces is from oral bacteria. What our study has shown is that is informing us that the patient has lost their gut bacteria. And so the percentage of oral bacteria found in feces could be a good marker that we lost our gut bacteria and, you know, could suggest that the patient needs to recover their gut microbiome.
Yeah.
Yeah, this has been a truly extraordinary conversation. I mean, you know, the idea that microbiology reaches out into so many areas of human health is just a fascinating one. And we need ecologists, modelers, because, you know, the days of working on single bacteria in test tubes, I think, has to not be over. I mean, it'll always have a value. But looking at microbes in their actual communities, I think, is the way forward. And I'm delighted to see that people like you are doing that work. So, Joe, thank you so much for joining us and sharing some of your data with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions, or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.